Although the news about the unemployment rate is not good, as Marilyn mentioned, there are job opportunities in some places. Kia Motors, the South Korean automaker, has been building cars in rural West Georgia for about a year now. The company recently announced it will add 1,000 new jobs. NPR's Kathy Lohr visited a town directly affected by that news.
LaGrange is not far from the Alabama border and only about 10 miles north of the Kia plant. The 30,000 residents here are proud of the small-town feel and the picturesque Courthouse Square.
We've got a fountain with a statue of Lafayette in the middle of it. All the shops have got all their Christmas decorations out, and tonight we light our Christmas tree in the middle of the square.
Jeff Lucan is mayor of LaGrange, and he almost always has a smile on his face. Lucan has a lot to be happy about since Kia moved to Troup County. This was once the hub of textile manufacturing, but in recent years, industries began to close, and then the recession hit.
In 2009, we lost 4 textile plants. In 2010, we lost another textile facility and 2 more manufacturing plants here. So I can't imagine what LaGrange would look like had it not been for Kia coming to locate here along with the Korean suppliers.
The city has attracted other large industries, including Caterpillar, Duracell, and a Walmart distribution center. But the unemployment rate in LaGrange remains higher than the national average. Mayor Lucan says that's in part because many people moved into the area when Kia was building its plant. In a previous round of hiring earlier this year, more than 44,000 people applied for just 1,000 jobs.
As soon as I heard about Kia's hiring, emails went out and people were notified right away.
Kay Duran runs the Center for Strategic Planning in LaGrange. She's in charge of a workforce development program to give those who live in the county an advantage in getting jobs.
Things are much better for us whenever I look around and hear some of the other stories when there are companies going out of business and there's no replacement there. But here we've got a lot more options. There's a lot more hope for people.
One of those applying for the new jobs is Riesel Peters, who moved to Troup County 7 years ago from Atlanta.
There's a lot of people who don't even have jobs. You know, they're hard to come by down here.
Peters has worked in manufacturing and most recently made $22 an hour in construction. But that industry is so slow that he only works a couple of days a week now. So he's hoping the Kia job comes through.
You know, it's better to have you got a paycheck coming each week. You know, with us contracting, you know, they might owe us $4,000 one week, but it might be a month before you get your money. And, you know, with this, it'll be a constant paycheck. I know we'll be there every week. You know, that's what I need.
Peter says he can barely wait 2 more weeks until he gets his first interview at Kia. The company had record sales in November, up 48% over last year, and that's in large part due to the popularity of the Kia Sorento built here. On a crisp evening in the town square at the Christmas tree lighting ceremony, most say they are grateful for the Kia jobs that are helping schools and local businesses.
Y'all want to throw the switch and light the tree? 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Georgia got Kia. Other southern states, including Alabama, South Carolina, and Tennessee, also lured foreign automakers, in part with huge tax incentives and because of a large non-union workforce. Officials here say they're seeing the payback they had hoped for. Kathy Lohr, NPR News.
The number of African Americans in the movie business is shockingly low. Here's one statistic. More than 500 movies came out last year. 9 of them had black directors. Or try this number. Last summer, there were only 2 Hollywood movies with a black male star at the top of the marquee. They were The Karate Kid, played by 12-year-old Jaden Smith, and Lottery Ticket, starring former Kid rapper Bow Wow. These statistics weren't news to Donnell Alexander, but this year he tried breaking into the business anyway.
I've co-produced a true story short movie about a pitcher who threw a no-hitter while tripping on acid. The thing's gone viral, and it's something very cool, according to both the internet and the film festival circuit. I want to make it into a movie that as many people as possible can see. So I've begun peddling it around Hollywood. Feedback is boiled down to, kid, don't bet on it. The Hitch, I'm told, is my protagonist. He's a black guy. And not your standard issue big movie black guy. A project like mine is a long shot, and that says something about the movie industry. But what? I don't have enough miles on my odometer to know, so I thought I'd ask other, more veteran filmmakers.
These conversations always come back to, you know, the booty call Rosewood conversation.
Indie director Barry Jenkins has a theory, one I'd heard before, which goes back to 97. Picture John Singleton still riding high off Boys in the Hood, deciding to do his prestige picture. A movie capable of showing that black films could do big business.
Hollywood put up the money, and John Singleton made Rosewood, which is a pretty good film, you know?
In 1923, the black town of Rosewood was a land of opportunity.
And the movie came out, you know, it's big budget, black Hollywood epic.
Tell me the truth. Was it truly a color, Don Distie?
And absolutely tanked. You know, no one went out and supported that film. And the very next weekend, Booty Call came out.
Dog, if you don't get... What is this? Hey.
Leave Killer alone. He does live here, and you are just visiting Buns.
Well, if we was really in China, I'd have his ass honey roasted.
A fraction of the budget. And absolutely, I mean, not to bash anyone who made Booty Call, but nowhere near as meritorious as Rosewood as a cultural endeavor.
Thing is, Booty Call totally makes me laugh, and not just because of the name. Jamie Foxx turns into a movie star right before your eyes.
Made tons of money. Made more money than Rosewood. And I think when you look at those two weekends back to back, and that was over a decade ago, I think it really is one of the first steps in what's gotten us to this point that you and I are having this conversation right now.
What lesson did the film industry take away from those consecutive weekends? That the blacks we put on screen will have to be broadly funny or flatly evil if we plan to recoup our investment. Aside from the occasional drama backed by a superstar like Oprah Winfrey, the thoughtful Hollywood film about and by black people went out with mobile pagers. Writer-director Michael Elliott has been making a living in Hollywood and says studio executives believe they can't sell tickets when they take a black movie overseas.
There's a whole huge stream of revenue that studios feel like they don't get to taste because the project's black. There is no foreign market for this, and we've been told this forever.
Elliott's made his way in the industry by producing modestly budgeted romantic comedies with black people in front of and usually behind the cameras. His latest, Just Right, did okay in theaters and as a DVD.
When am I going to meet that one amazing guy who thinks I'm the one woman he can't live without?
The success of Just Right was based on having Queen Latifah, a bankable star, which is to say, capable of bringing in an audience on opening weekend. The list Hollywood keeps of bankable black female leads has two names.
The list is like, it's really, 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 really small. There's moments where Halle Berry is on that list and Queen Latifah is on that list. And that's where it stops. On the male side, there's actors who are really not on the list because they have such a mainstream and foreign appeal, a la Will Smith, Denzel Washington. Those men aren't really considered black actors.
Hold the phone. Denzel and Will aren't black? You lost me.
Meaning that they have such crossover appeal to white people that white people don't really view them as like black. They view Will Smith as Will Smith. They don't really see him. They don't see color.
Whatever. My man with the booty call theory knew he couldn't get Will Smith for his movie. It's a low-budget sleeper called Medicine for Melancholy. In it, two strangers bike and dance around San Francisco in the wake of drunken stranger party sex.
It seems like the city just pisses you off.
Nah, I love this city. I hate this city, but I love this city. San Francisco's beautiful. You shouldn't have to be upper middle class to be a part of that.
Medicine for Melancholy screened in just three American cities, one at a time, and then Barry Jenkins took it on to the international festival circuit.
And I went to Krakow, Poland, Toronto, Buenos Aires, Mar del Plata, to Paris, London, and the reaction was always absolutely amazing. Literally, I had people say to me in many different languages, "We've never seen black people like this before." And I was like, "Well, they exist in pretty much every city."
I want to do what Barry Jenkins did: make a picture about compelling people in situations that captivate. Characters our complicated racial past is kept at bay, but I want to make money. The closest the industry has come to this in recent history is with Precious. That one made money, both at home and abroad. The project also happened to have the Tyler Perry and Oprah brands behind it. Even so, Precious wasn't made by Hollywood. It came up through the festival circuit.
It was an example of a film that began at Sundance and then went to Toronto and then in the marketplace tracked when these movies are allowed to actually perform and they're supported properly. I think a lot of these urban legends or these Hollywood legends that we like to talk about, they're disproven.
It's important not to take the urban legends too personally. In the film history, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, Peter Biskin wrote, "Because movies are expensive and time-consuming to make, Hollywood is always the last to know, the slowest to respond. In times of economic austerity, it's not the obvious move to make more big black films. But who knows? Maybe some other filmmaker will create a hit with a black point of view and characters born of it, and it'll do boffo box office all over, and I'll get a meaningful studio meeting. But I'm fully prepared to book a flight to Krakow. Word is that the Poles dig films about complicated black Americans."
Donnell Alexander is the author of the book Ghetto Celebrity, Searching for My Father in Me. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has been characterized as everything from a righteous crusader against government and corporate oppression to a traitor deserving nothing less than execution. His most recent data dump of 250,000 diplomatic cables has brought him more praise and more derision. Mr. Assange leads a life on the run, both from governments that want to prosecute him and from police agencies that want to extradite him to Sweden for questioning on allegations of rape. He lives simultaneously in the shadows and in the spotlight. John Burns, the London bureau chief of the New York Times, sat down with Mr. Assange for a revealing interview in October and has continued to follow the WikiLeaks stories. He joins us from the BBC in Cambridge. Good morning to you.
Yes, good morning.
Before we get to his current troubles, can you give us just a little bit of biographical information on Mr. Assange? Specifically, what was his childhood like in Australia?
He was brought up by his mother. And it was a nomadic life. I think he had some troubles in school. In fact, he wasn't very often in school. And by his mid-teens, he had evolved, which is, you know, 20, 25 years ago now, he'd evolved into one of the early computer hackers, eventuating 4 years ago in his founding WikiLeaks. Mm.
He disdains being characterized as a hacker now. How does he define himself?
Well, now he has a kind of millennial mission in his own mind. When listening to him, one has the impression that he intends to remake the world. He talks about sweeping away the poison of secrecy, of creating a world of information without borders. But he goes well beyond that now. He's talking about, and he talks insistently and sometimes virulently about the corruption of democracy. He regards the United States as an enemy of democracy. And so to his original agenda of drawing back the veil, he's now added another agenda, which is more explicitly political.
Mm. People who know him have described him as imperious, a control freak, an ideologue, an egomaniac, a genius, and unique. How would you describe him?
And he's certainly not the easiest person to deal with, especially when you write about him. Mm. All of those descriptions, many of them, could be applied to many of the people who have changed the world by one degree or more. There's no doubt that what Julian Assange is doing, he's a pioneer of a kind, and that he's having a very big impact. And he struck me as being, yes, brilliant, capricious, arrogant, but not terribly self-knowing and not gifted, I have to say, with much of a sense of irony.
His detractors say he's reckless, he puts lives at risk. How does he react to that kind of criticism?
His answer to that is to say, the Pentagon refused to help us, improbable as it may seem. He actually requested the Pentagon to help him edit the documents that he had received. He said they're to blame because they didn't help us. And his second response, which is troubling, I must say, is to say that if you're going to do good in the world, then sometimes it has ill effects, and you have to judge whether the good outweighs the ill effects.
He will be living in the shadows. His British visa expires early next year.
Yes, I think he's already living in the shadows. He has done for quite a long time. I think those nomadic years in Australia prepared him for this. His entire life he carries in a rucksack on his back. He rarely spends more than a night or two in the same place. He's strange because, as you said in your introduction, he lives in the spotlight, occasionally popping up at news conferences and bathing in the celebrity, and then he disappears again. As of right now, as best we know it, he is somewhere in southeast England staying with friends. He doesn't answer mobile telephone calls himself. He entrusts his mobile phones, which he switches, as I said in my profile of him, like other men switch shirts. He entrusts his mobile phones to associates of his. There's an elaborate clearance procedure before you meet him. He's very concerned about his security, and who knows, maybe he has reason to, but he's in a very vexed situation now because these two warrants for his arrest are valid in something like 188 countries. And whilst they're, in a sense, passive, that's to say, at least in the UK, Scotland Yard has said they won't go out looking for him, they will arrest him if he comes onto their radar screen, which means if he goes to an airport or a port or he holds a press conference, he's likely to be arrested. So it's really no wonder that he has become once again the fugitive.
John Burns is the London bureau chief of the New York Times. His profile of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange appeared in the paper in October. He joined us from the BBC in Cambridge. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish in for Guy Raz. 2010 started with unemployment at a grim 9.7%. We're headed toward the year's end with a downright Grinch-like 9.8%. This was not on the White House holiday wish list.
There's no denying that that the report is disappointing. There's too much pain out there. There's still millions of people out of work. Trying to make do with without a paycheck and without the dignity and respect that goes with a job.
That's Vice President Joe Biden at the White House after Friday's jobs report. On Capitol Hill, lawmakers are using unemployment benefits as a sweetener for a deal on the Bush-era tax cuts, working on a compromise that would temporarily extend both policies. But for many of the long-term unemployed, time has run out. Until this past week, emergency jobless benefits lasted as long as 99 weeks for people in the hardest-hit states. But with five people unemployed for every job available, 99 weeks might not be long enough. Our cover story today, The Price of Living Without Work.
My name is Yvette Ward.
My name is Alexandra Jaron.
Richard Iritano.
Teresa Ray Colvo.
Aaron Elson.
My last job was with the City of Philadelphia.
I was working as a dispatcher for 34 years.
Director of Client Services.
Director of Business Development.
I used to work as a copy editor at a newspaper, and my last unemployment check was in mid-June.
March.
August. It was Sunday, March 28th, 2010.
I went from making about $70,000 to $405 a week on unemployment.
I've professionally worked for about 35 years. I've always worked.
You're not prepared to be unemployed. You're not prepared to be homeless. You're not prepared to be hungry.
When I stopped working, I was living month to month. Then when unemployment benefits began, it was week to week. Now I live minute to minute.
As the time went by, it just got more desperate.
And it's an insidious way to live. It's destructive.
I just started to apply for entry-level positions, service positions, every fast food. I've applied everywhere.
I've never had this problem before with getting employment.
I used to edit stories in the business section about how people should diversify their portfolio and what they should do with their 401k. Well, I can tell you what I did with my 401k. It went to subsidize my unemployment insurance. And so now I, you know, have no 401k, no income. And also I gave up my apartment and moved into an office. I rented an office. So like some people have a home office, I have an office home.
You fear every day of what will become of you.
There's a sense of shame and dishonor, and people look at you differently.
I'd watch C-SPAN, I'd watch the Congress debate, I'd watch the Senate talk, and nothing. And then they would leave town and go away.
I haven't taken the time to register it or digest it.
You felt like you didn't count as a person anymore.
It took a period of time to get food stamps, so I went without food for a while. It's really a sad thing to say, but the one thing that kind of saved me, Nashville had the flood, and it destroyed buildings, and it destroyed the building that had the paperwork for my eviction. And so my eviction was put off.
I have a sister who lives in a gated community in Boca Raton. It's palatial. How am I supposed to tell her I'm sleeping on the floor of my office, you know?
I planned my life the way so many others do, and I never imagined that I would be living in this kind of a situation.
I miss the structure, being somewhere at a certain time and doing something for 7 or 8 hours.
Nobody wants to sit around all day long and do nothing.
Any job that would give me a salary would be the perfect job.
We are a huge, huge population of people that just want jobs.
The voices of a few of the long-term unemployed. Arthur Goldsmith studies the psychological toll of unemployment. He's an economics professor at Washington and Lee University in Virginia.
What we know about joblessness is that it unseeds a person in many ways. So, for instance, work organizes a person's day. It connects you with other people. It places you in part of something that's bigger than just you. And that's very satisfying to most people. And when they lose their job, they miss that. And that loss of agency can be really quite damaging. It can lead to anxiety. It can lead to somatization, difficulty sleeping. It can certainly bring on bouts of depression. You also might cope by engaging in some, what I would describe as self-destructive behaviors, abuse of alcohol and other drugs. You might have violent outbursts. And, of course, those things are quite adverse to your long-run well-being.
You mentioned after a certain amount of weeks, if you're not finding work, say after 5 weeks or so, you may go through different sort of stages, almost mimicking the stages of grief, I guess.
In the early phase, people are typically quite reactant, which means that they give a good effort, they search hard, and they believe that the bout will be short and a good night's sleep and it'll all be over. But when you have extensive duration of unemployment and that helplessness sets in, that then begins to change your mindset, but it also alters the way that potential employers look at you.
We're hearing the argument that getting unemployment benefits, that people who are getting them essentially aren't getting jobs, aren't moving on to jobs because of the unemployment benefits, because they have something in place.
There is some evidence that as people get very close to the end of their unemployment benefits, there's a spike or an increase in the likelihood that they'll find work. But the question is whether they're finding work that'll be long-term and satisfying to them.
So you don't subscribe to the sort of a job is a job? Because some people would say if you can get a job, that you should take it.
I think that's a very naive way of thinking about it. And in fact, one of the things about this recession that makes it so different than other recessions is that this one started in Wall Street and has spread to Main Street. If you look at the people that have been predominantly unemployed early on in this recession back in 2007 and 8, and who are still now suffering some of these long bouts, they were very, very skilled people, and they had established certain expectations, certain lifestyles. If they were to take a job that would not enhance their marketability in the future, it could actually be damaging to them as they search for jobs when the economy actually begins to grow again, which looks like it'll happen in 2011 and 12.
Arthur Goldsmith is an economics professor at Washington and Lee University in Virginia. Arthur Goldsmith, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you, Audie.
In the last 60 years, the federal government has consistently extended emergency unemployment benefits whenever the jobless rate's been more than 7.5%. But economist Kevin Hassett says it's time to rethink the federal unemployment insurance program altogether. He's the director of economic policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute.
In Germany, they have a program that is called work sharing. Kurzarbeit is the actual German word, short work. And what work sharing does is it allows an employer to reduce somebody's hours and their take-home pay, say 20%, 30%, 40%, and then have that person receive a fraction of the unemployment insurance they would have got if they were laid off completely. And so what that does is it incents employers to, instead of taking one person and kicking them off the grounds of the firm, they can take five people, reduce their hours 20%, and have the same labor cost savings for the firm, and those individuals will then get, say, 20% of their unemployment insurance. And that's good for employers because when they start to expand again, they don't have to have a costly search for new workers. And it's great for workers because they don't have to be disconnected from the workforce and they don't have to go through the shame of saying they're unemployed. So it's a program that's a lot better than what we do, and it's very, very puzzling that we haven't been able to get the American government, the federal government, to bet more money on work sharing.
But is there evidence that in these places where they do have these programs, when things get better, employers bring everyone back to full hours and bring back up their wages?
Generally, what happens is that the countries that have work sharing programs will suspend them when times are good again. And so you could imagine, I think in the U.S., most economists think the economy is growing maybe in the 2.5% range now, but the unemployment rate's very high. If we started growing 4 or 5% and the unemployment rate dropped a couple of percent, well, then we would suspend the work sharing program.
What are some other alternatives out there to the current system?
The other type of system that people talk a lot about is one where the compensation that you get from the unemployment insurance program isn't so heavily dependent on the duration of your spell of unemployment. And so instead of, you know, cutting you a check every week, we could instead give you, you know, a big lump sum payment up front, or maybe a big lump sum payment in the first 4 weeks and then another one for the, you know, second half. What that would do is it would make it so that you're not really penalized if you take a job early.
This is fast becoming a record period of unemployment in terms of the length of time that the economy has been suffering. How has it changed the way you look at unemployment?
Well, I think that one of the things that we have to recognize is that the longer somebody doesn't have a job, the harder it is to get a new job. You know, the reality is that if you're out of job and you're looking for a job, then the new employer is going to say, well, you know, why don't you have a job now? What's wrong with you? And so what can be kind of a cyclical unemployment becomes a structural problem for the U.S. because we have a large set of discouraged people who are kind of disconnected from society, disconnected from the workforce. And so it's really urgent that people put down their political labels and start to gather together and think about what we can do to help folks who have been unemployed for a long time before we do create a kind of, you know, second society of people that really are disconnected.
That's Kevin Hassett. He's the Director of Economic Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Kevin, thanks so much.
Thanks. It's been great to be here.
Jane Yolen is one of the most published writers in the United States. She's been called America's Hans Christian Andersen. The author is best known for her picture books for children and novels for young adults. As Jill Kaufman from member station WFCR reports, Yolen hit a milestone this year. Her 300th book was published.
Jane Yolen lives in Hatfield, Massachusetts, a rural town of tobacco crops and looming barns and thick woods lining the banks of the Connecticut River. When the natural world figures into Yolen's stories, you can see where she gets some of her inspiration. Like a good book, Yolen's house is something you can get lost in.
Hey, hi. That's my daughter Heidi, with whom I've written 15 books.
Lately, instead of climbing the winding stairs to her office, Yolen likes to write here in this room just off the entryway. She has officially 300 published books under her belt and counting, but she's not the one keeping the tally. She writes historical fiction, much of it based in the time of King Arthur. She writes nonfiction, fantasy, science fiction. Her book, The Devil's Arithmetic, was made into a movie starring Kirsten Dunst. And not least of all, Yolen writes children's picture books.
I think picture books should stretch children. I think they should be full of wonderful, amazing words.
But she says more and more her publishers tell her she's too literary. Several years ago, she wrote a series of books with the character of Piggins, a pig butler who solves mysteries. The story starts with the disappearance of a diamond lavalier.
Well, the editor first said, I think we can better just say necklace. I think lavalier is too big a word for kids this age. But we held the fort. We said, yes, absolutely, it's going to be lavalier. And when Jane Dyer, the illustrator, and I went on a book tour together, every school we went to, the kids had voted that lavalier was their favorite new word.
Yolen's books are among the many used in Deborah Felix's kindergarten classroom at the Fort River Elementary School in Amherst, Massachusetts. About 20 kindergartners settle down on the floor as Felix gets ready to read.
All right. Do you know what we're going to read today? Owl Moon?
Yolen wrote Owl Moon in 1987. It was illustrated by John Schoner.
What do you notice about this picture?
There's an owl in the sky.
There is an owl. Do you remember what kind of owl we thought it might be?
Snow owl.
I don't think it was a snowy owl.
A great horned owl.
A great horned owl. That's right.
I was going
to
say that.
All right, so let's get started. It was late one winter night, long past my bedtime, when Pa and I went owling.
Felix is using Owl Moon to finish up a unit on trees. She stops every few seconds to point out metaphors like snow whiter than milk in a cereal bowl, or big words like shrugged. And here comes the kids' favorite part.
We reached the line of pine trees, black and pointy against the sky, and Pa held up his hand, and I stopped right where I was and waited. What do you think they're waiting for?
An owl.
An owl, exactly. He looked up as if searching the stars, as if reaching a map up there, and the moon made his face into a silver mask. And then he called. Who's going to make it first? The dad. Oh, listen.
Owl Moon won the most prestigious of children's book awards, the Caldecott. But if anything has made Yolen and the illustrator Mark Teague household names, it's their series on how dinosaurs do a variety of things, like say, I love you, eat food, or go to sleep. The writing is markedly different than all Yolen's other work, not as literary, but lots of rhyming with clauses like, does a dinosaur slam his tail and pout? Does he throw his teddy bear all about? Millions have sold, and Yolen says this is what pays the bills. And if Yolen, in her 30-year career, had to stick to one type of writing, she says she might as well have worked in a factory.
She's one of those writers that I hold up, particularly for young writers today, to encourage them to believe they can work in many different forms.
Anita Silvey was a longtime editor at Hornbook Magazine, the so-called Bible of children's literature. She's the author of numerous compendiums listing great books for young readers. She says Yolen is among a handful of writers who've made lasting contributions to children's literature. But Yolen says her greatest hope is to share a sense of what matters most in life.
Honesty, standing up for the underdog, being heroic in the small sense, if not the large sense. And I don't care if it's a fantasy novel where people are doing great deeds or a small book like Elsie's Bird where she does a very heroic thing.
Without giving away the ending, to save her bird from death, young Elsie runs courageously into the grasses of a vast prairie, a place she previously feared. And Elsie's Bird is what Yolen finally decided would be her official 300th book.
Elsie was a Boston girl. From the time she was a little child, hair and pigtails, she knew the cozy harbor, where gulls screamed at fishing boats, where the fish merchants called, fresh cod, fresh.
For NPR News, I'm Jill Kaufman in Western Massachusetts.
She would run along the lazy curves of the busy streets, listening to the clop of horses' hooves on stone cobbles. She played skip-ball.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. The number of Americans who believe that global warming is a scientific fact has been dropping. Environmental groups and climate scientists who say the evidence for warming is clear are scratching their heads over this reversal. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, they're scrambling to find a new strategy.
3 years ago, former Vice President Al Gore won a Nobel Prize for publicizing the threat of climate change with his book and documentary film, An Inconvenient Truth. Dan Lashoff at the Natural Resources Defense Council, an environmental group, says scientists rejoiced.
We in the scientific community, by and large, said, okay, science debate is over. We're going to move our efforts into talking about what we do about it. And that left the science debate in the public largely untended. That has been recognized as a strategic error.
They hadn't won. climate skeptics worked to convince the public that the scientific argument for climate change was dodgy and exaggerated. The debate sometimes got hostile and personal, as in this exchange between climate skeptic Mark Morano and climate activist Joe Rome.
There is no warming. Look at ocean heat content. It's all a fantasy land. It's a fantasy land that Joe Rome is
promoting. Response?
Yeah, I do need to respond to it. The thing you have to understand about Mark Morano is that he basically makes stuff up and misrepresents science.
Wow.
And,
Going right for the jugular there.
I didn't interrupt you.
No, you didn't.
Even Al Gore's Nobel Prize hasn't earned him deference from skeptics. Here he's testifying at a hearing before Republican Congressman Joe Barton.
At the same time, it's getting warmer in the troposphere, the lower atmosphere. That's exactly what the models predict. That's exactly
what the science says.
And now,
what's your answer on the cafe?
If I could complete my response, Congressman, the idea about
CO2. I hope there's an answer
CO2
in there somewhere.
May I?
So now, climate activists are doing some soul searching about where they've gone wrong. For one thing, they've been preaching to the choir. Opinion polls show that attitudes about climate change increasingly fall along political lines. Conservatives are more likely to be skeptics, liberals to be believers. Climate scientist Richard Somerville at the University of California, San Diego, says scientists aren't necessarily welcome among some conservatives.
They don't want to hear about it from scientists who they regard as opposed to them on many, many wedge issues, abortion and stem cells or evolution and creationism.
And then there's the message. Alden Meyer with the Union of Concerned Scientists says climate activists need to offer solutions, not just problems. But old habits are hard to break. I showed Meyer a brand new book on climate change, World on the Edge. And here is the table of contents. Falling water tables and shrinking harvests, eroding soils, expanding deserts, rising temperatures, melting ice, environmental refugees, mounting stresses, failing states. This is grim. Meyer agrees.
If you offer people only the bad news and the dire straits and no prospect of being able to address it, there's a natural human tendency to deny the reality of the problem because they don't want to believe that there's no way out and that we're doomed.
And there are some environmental scientists who think the threat has been exaggerated. Ken Green is with the American Enterprise Institute.
By focusing always on these extreme threats, I think they lost their credibility. I mean, historically, as we have doomsayers, they keep getting it wrong, and people keep seeing that they're getting it wrong.
Finally, there's the economy.
When people feel less wealthy, they're less inclined to listen to arguments that they need to spend more money. And it also may mean doubting the motives of the person who's telling them to spend the money.
So far, there's lots of talk about what to do. One group that's already changing its tune is the Nature Conservancy. It's now run by a former Goldman Sachs executive. Mark Tursek says the Conservancy's message is going to show that protecting the climate isn't just about saving polar bears. It's local.
We're talking about protecting what people need from nature. Clean water, clean air, good food.
All things that could suffer as the climate warms. As for the messenger, well, the Conservancy has just hired a new marketing director from the professional wrestling business. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.